Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, fj@offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Tis Friday at last, and today's episode is an archive show, but it was last published at least 2.5 years ago, so unless you're a super hardcore listener, it's probably new to you. Thanks for joining me this morning, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on December 30th of 2019 under the headline, Bear Grylls of the 1910s Had Something to Prove. Here we go. On the morning of Tuesday, July 21st, 1914, deep in the heart of the wilderness of the Siskiyous near the little hamlet of Holland, a naked man was soberly shaking the hand of an official-looking gentleman as several others looked on. Then the naked man turned and padded away into the woods. Barefoot. Mr. Birthday Suit's name was Joe Knowles. He was, in essence, the Bear Grylls of the 1910s, an expert woodsman and wilderness survivalist getting ready to demonstrate his skills for a nationwide audience. Like Bear Grylls, he was the real thing, but he'd been caught cutting some corners on his last show. This was the beginning of the demonstration that he hoped would prove, once and for all, that he could do it. At the same time, he hoped it would be an answer to a question that was very much on Americans' minds back then in the twilight years of the long 19th century. Is civilization making us soft and degenerate? Joe hoped to prove that it was not, at least not yet, and that a healthy American man, equipped only with what the good Lord had given him, could step out into a howling wilderness and carve out of its natural bounty a comfortable life for himself. But Joe's other motivation for his Oregon demonstration, the real reason, most likely, wasn't one he alluded to in the newspapers. The other reason Joe wanted to prove himself in Oregon was to redeem his reputation. That reputation, for good and for ill, had been forged the previous year when he had plunged naked into the wilderness of northern Maine. At the time, he was living in Boston. For years he'd been getting by as a wilderness guide, and he was augmenting his income by working part-time for the Boston Post as a commercial artist. The plan for the Nature Man stunt was developed with a friend and co-worker at the Post named Michael McKeow. It was worked out in great detail, pitched and sold to the Post, and put into practice in the summer of 1913. Joe would plunge into the wildest wilderness, stark naked but for a loincloth, and prove that he could wrest a living from Mother Nature's reluctant hands. Each week, Joe would drop off a stack of correspondence, drawings done on birch bark with a charred twig from his fire, and letters written the same way, in a designated location under a stump. McKeow, who had rented a cabin near the stump to serve as a sort of Joe Knowles bureau office and was enjoying a sort of paid working vacation in the woods, would retrieve the birch barks, type them up, and convey them to the Boston Post, which would, of course, publish them. 2 months later, a scruffy, thickly bearded Knowles emerged from the woods wearing sandals he'd woven from tree bark, a bear skin taken from a bear that he had trapped in a pit and clubbed to death, and other garments made from the hide of a deer that he'd caught and killed with his bare hands. At that point, the Boston Post was likely very glad it had worked with Knowles, because the whole thing was playing very well with the American public. The drama and romance quickly captured the imagination of an America that still hadn't quite gotten used to not being a frontier country anymore. And there was another thing. The average American liked his or her modern comforts, streetcars, steam heat, indoor plumbing. But according to the recently popularized theories of eugenics, the gene stock of a race of people was only kept strong through adversity and struggle. Would a soft modern life cause Americans to inevitably degenerate into a soft, decadent bunch of immoral pleasure seekers and drug addicts? But now, here came Joe Knowles, the American Adam, to prove that if degeneracy were indeed the destiny of the race, it hadn't happened yet, and a naked American man could still take on a howling wilderness and thrive there, just as well as his ancestors could. And when he did, the whole country cheered and celebrated. Well, not the whole country. The Boston Post's rival newspaper, the Boston American, was extremely skeptical, not to mention envious. It promptly published an article presenting a strong argument, backed with some circumstantial evidence, that Joe hadn't spent the entire 2 months in the wilderness. It pointed out that Mikiau had had a very handy cabin well stocked with Joe's favorite brand of beer, and it claimed that his animal skins had been tanned by commercial process and had bullet holes in them. He had, the American claimed, simply stayed in the cabin with Mikiau for 2 months, working on his tan and growing his beard and sketching scenes he made up in his head. This claim was shortly thereafter piled onto with devastating effect by Mikiau. Joe's friendship with him did not survive the summer. The two men were bitter enemies almost immediately after Joe's return to civilization. That may have had something to do with the fact that Joe, upon his return, quit the Boston Post and went to work for his erstwhile nemesis, the Boston American. It is very difficult to suss out the truth from the conflicting accounts of Joe's two-month wilderness sojourn. The picture that the bitter Mikiau painted of his ex-friend was so unflattering and vicious, and claimed him to be so incompetent and thick-witted that it's really not credible. But neither is Joe's official account. Now as then, it seems very likely that Joe cheated, at least a little and probably a lot. If nothing else, the allegations that the animal skins were commercially tanned could be tested by having a neutral third party examine them, and the fact that this was not done, so far as I've been able to learn, is particularly damning. There was, however, one thing that even Joe Knowles had to admit. As a longtime trapper and wilderness guide in the North Maine woods, Joe knew the country. Even if he had played the whole thing straight, was it really a fair test for him to plunge into a woodland whose every plant and shrub he knew, the poisonous from the nutritious, and the habits of whose animals he was intimately familiar with? Arguably, no. But America wouldn't have to just wonder about this, because now that Joe's experiment in the Maine woods was over, William Randolph Hearst, his new employer, was ready to sponsor a second experiment. Joe would plunge, naked, into a wilderness a continent away from his friends and their suspicious stocks of beer. There would be third-party observers in the form of well-known university professors. Joe would prove his bona fides once and for all, and silence the critics. Hearst's entire newspaper empire was at the ready. "Wild beasts roar invitation to Joe Knowles," howled a banner headline in the San Francisco Examiner. Other newspapers, such as the Portland Morning Oregonian, carried the news on their front pages under more conventional headlines. Nature Man Starts Tuesday, for instance. Into the woods went Joe, and immediately made the single biggest mistake of his career as a public woodsman. Quote, "Joe Knowles' first action in going to the woods is to pick up a sharp stone," explained Professor T.T. Waterman of the University of California, one of the professors who was monitoring the experiment. "The second is to hack through the bark of a white cedar, pull loose a long strip of bark, and extract the fiber. As he presses forward into the forests, he twists this fiber into strings as he walks. Before he has gone 5 miles, he will have this fiber twisted into sandals." The problem was, by the time Joe had walked 5 miles, it would be too late to put on sandals. Because throughout this little barefoot meander, Joe was apparently making his way through fields of small, woody plants with glossy, oak-shaped leaves clustered in groups of three. He didn't recognize them. Why should he? Poison oak doesn't grow in the North Maine woods. Now, a really bad case of poison oak is bad enough, but when it's all over the feet, that's quite a bit worse. A miner who came across him halfway through his month told reporters he couldn't believe Joe hadn't contracted blood poisoning from it. Joe had hoped to emerge from the woods on this attempt wearing another bear skin, or even, his fondest hope, leading a bear cub that he'd befriended. With his feet in the condition they were in, though, he quickly found himself subsisting on fish and huckleberries. These got the job done, but not much more than that. Then, a little over a week into the ordeal, a second blow fell, and it would be this one that would essentially end Joe's bid for the enduring national fame he sought. Half a world away, the particularly arrogant and thick-headed hereditary ruler of Germany sent his army over the border into Belgium on an ill-fated quest to take France by surprise. The First World War was underway. With a story like that unfolding in real time, there was no room on the front pages of America's newspapers for the woodland adventures of some naked guy beating through the bushes of southern Oregon. The Morning Oregonian kept a steady flow of news coverage going, but it was no longer on the front page. And when the 30th day came along and Joe had completed what he'd committed to, he abandoned his plan to extend his sojourn and came in. Other than the San Francisco and Portland papers, hardly anyone noticed. Joe Knowles was just no longer news. With Hearst's help, Knowles tried again in 1916, in the Adirondacks of upstate New York. This time he served as a wilderness survival trainer for two dawn girls who were going to plunge into the wilderness naked, under the supervision of a chaperone, of course. At the same time, several miles away, Knowles would be making a third demonstration of his own. But one of the dawn girls dropped the project before it even started, and the other lasted only a week or two before throwing in the towel. She couldn't stand the mosquitoes. And when she quit, so did almost all the media coverage. For several years after this last stunt, Joe made regular personal appearances at talks and lectures as the famous nature man at theaters and halls. But when Stuart Holbrook found him a couple decades after his woodcraft demonstrations, he was living with his wife on the coast of Washington, just north of Cape Disappointment, in a funny little cabin built with driftwood and bits of wrecked ships, and working as a freelance commercial artist specializing in wildlife and Western art. To the end of his days, he maintained that his demonstration of woodsmanship in Maine was the real thing. And he told Holbrook he had just two regrets. First, that he didn't manage to befriend a bear cub, and second, that stupid war. Key sources in this story included works by Stuart Holbrook, Joseph Knowles, Richard Boyer, and the archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do, or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. By the way, if you like this kind of stuff, you might be interested in my other podcast. It's called the Penny Dreadful Story Podcast, and it's basically an early Victorian variety show. I read a chapter from each of six classic Penny Dreadful story papers published between 1840 and 1866 with historical and sociological commentary and definitions of the flash cant slang lingo used by Romany family coves and bold highway robbers and titled Regency roisterers and so forth. It comes out twice a week. On Saturdays, Part 1 features stories from early in the Penny Dreadful era, Mysteries of London, Varney the Vampire, and Sweeney Todd. On Wednesdays, Part 2 features stories from late in the Penny Dreadful era, Highwayman Dick Turpin, Spring-Heeled Jack, and an international espionage series called The Black Band. Check it out. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can cut straight to it at pulp-lit.com/pennydread, all one word, all lowercase. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so, well, it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix, but I don't have to tell you that Monday morning will be here in the blink of an eye, right? Well, that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon History's Sulphur Springs studio, and now it's time for both you and me to go out and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend, too, with good stuff. Bye now.